A Life of Jesus by Brother Melva Purkis, Book 6, Chapter 7. When he was yet a great way off. Wherever Jesus went, he drew to him publicans and sinners, men separated from their fellows by their means of livelihood and their way of life. It was one of the Pharisees' greatest problems. They could not understand the attitude of Jesus in allowing these men even to approach him. That he should talk with them and sink to the depravity of accepting their hospitality was horrifying. His wonderful answer that he had come as a physician to tend the sick and must therefore be among them had not satisfied these Pharisees. So developed was the sense of their own righteousness and so ingrained their contempt of these people that the simile seemed lost on them. They could only understand the righteousness which was marked by separation from sinners. They have no difficulty in appreciating the asceticism of the Old Testament prophets, and even that of John the Baptist in the wilderness. But this man encouraged these outcasts from decent society, and whether he was in Judea, Galilee, or even out here in the Jordan Valley, they flocked to him. Now, whilst he was speaking of the demands of discipleship, they had surrounded him, and he'd even shared a meal with them. The latest example of their aversion led Jesus to a more detailed justification of his attitude than he had yet expressed. We may be thankful for it because it evoked the three great parables of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. In these human stories, Jesus brought out the wonderful truth that while the Pharisees were murmuring on earth and keeping their distance from these men who'd come to Jesus, the Father himself and the holy angels were rejoicing that they who had been lost were now found. Moreover, the further lesson emerges that the position of the sinner who comes to the Father is far happier than that of those who cling to their ceremonial righteousness. They may not have gone astray in any conventional sense, but they have not come to Jesus. The three parables form a beautiful harmony. The first two show the seeking love of God in his Son and in his Church. And the third traces the progress of the responsive love of man towards God. The first parable is a vivid and faithful picture of the true shepherd who, discovering that one of his sheep is lost, dedicates himself to the task of finding it. He does not count the cost, and he is undeterred by the weariness of the way, the rocks that bruise his feet, or the thorns which tear his flesh. At last he finds it. Artistic imagination has painted it high up on some well-nigh inaccessible rock, lonely, hungry and helpless. There's no anger in the shepherd's voice as he calls, no rebuke at the waywardness which has caused him such trouble. He is the shepherd still. He does not drive it back to the pasture. He does not even call it to follow him. Reaching out, he gently lifts it to his tired shoulders and brings it to the fold amidst heavenly rejoicings. In the second parable, Jesus becomes prophetic. The picture is a more intimate one. The wilderness has become the house. The 100 sheep become the 10 coins. The rich landowner has become the poor woman who's lost a coin, and lighting a candle sweeps the house and diligently searches until she finds it. Then she calls her friends and neighbours, bidding them to rejoice with her, because she has found what she had lost. Jesus seems to be speaking here of the time when his disciples, continuing his work, have become his church. But the emphasis remains upon the love of God, the importance of those that were lost, and the joy of restoration. But the story of the prodigal son is surely the most moving of all the parables of Jesus. His three characters were the very actors in this drama by the fords of Jordan. The publicans and sinners who, ashamed of their ways, had come to Jesus to be lovingly received and protected from the scribes and Pharisees, the representatives of legal righteousness, who betrayed their true character in their lovelessness and in their unconscious admission of their hypocrisy. Above all, the love of God revealed in Jesus, which is the true home of both brothers. It is a love which goes out to meet the younger one when he's come to himself and realised the folly and degradation of natural propensities. It's also a love which gently reasons with the uglier disposition of the elder, imploring him to come into the feast and share the Father's blessings. We shall be the poorer if we do not often meditate upon this beautiful parable, shining in the sunlight of the Father's love in Jesus. It bears an intensely personal application for each one of us. We do not often go with the younger brother quite so far away from home, nor are many of us reduced to the degradation which was needful for him. Yet, dare any of us claim that our feet have not strayed out onto the selfish paths of our natural inheritance? Has not every one of us sought to use the portion of goods that falleth to us for our own pleasure? Few of us are so surly and hypocritical as the elder brother, but a sensitive awareness will show us when we are taking upon ourselves his likeness. It is a sober thought that the fact that we never leave our father's home does not mean that we are nearer to him than our brother, who, though far away amongst the swine, is beginning to realise what he's left, and is saying in his heart, "I will arise and go unto my father." Dominating the whole scene is the love of God. If we are far away, it seeks us out across the wilderness to call us home. If we dwell beneath its wings, it penetrates into the dark corners of our hearts and searches our motives. Responding to it, the older and the younger brother can meet together, the hands clasped in fellowship, and enjoy the love feast that the Father has prepared for them. We cannot leave this parable without seeking to extract from it a lesson in prayer. The younger brother's first approach to his father was the natural cry of a child, and is the spiritual cry of an immature Christian. It was a petition, "Give me the portion of goods." But when experience had taught him wisdom, he began to understand the true meaning of fatherhood, and eventually, having come to himself, he approached his father once more. But it was no longer, "Father, give me," it was, "Father, make me." And so it is with us. Only the varied experiences of our spiritual warfare, which brings increasing confidence in God, will give us that maturity which leads us from simple prayers of petition to the intense habitual communication which seeks only the Father's transforming love and desires only to be like him. The Pharisees heard this story with some grimness. They could not miss its meaning nor its invitation to join the publicans and sinners in enjoying the blessings of his Father's love. But the elder brother maintained his surliness. He preferred to continue his hurt self-righteousness and thus also to retain that approbation of men which he so dearly loved. Jesus saw that the appeal of his word pictures was lost upon them. He turned to his disciples and described these men to them, bringing out their inconsistency and summarising all hypocrisy in trenchant words which reached beyond the history of these men who served God to please men. "No servant can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. He cannot serve God and mammon." The scribes and Pharisees, stung by his words, curled their lips in sneers. But Jesus reminded them that however much they sought to justify themselves before men, God knew their hearts. This was the final test. To bring home its force, he told them the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. In doing so, he used their own conception of the afterlife, not because they were literally true, but because they forcibly illustrated the lesson he was teaching them. In the eyes of men, the condition of Lazarus could not bear comparison with the comfort and opulence of the rich man. Yet when their relative positions in the sight of God were revealed, the situation was exactly reversed. The rich man had become the beggar in dire straits, longing for the simple gift of a drop of water from the hand of him who'd once desired the crumbs from his table. The beggar had become the rich man, enjoying comfort and plenty. In his wonderful way, Jesus used the occasion to bring home a further lesson which the Pharisees needed. Having drawn the picture in colours which compelled their attention, he represented the tormented man, pleading that someone may be sent to warn his brethren of their ways, that he might be saved from bitter disillusionment. But the ways of God have been revealed. The relationship between God and man and the standard God requires have been fully shown. His constant warnings against hypocrisy were clear and forceful. If they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded though one rose from the dead. Within a week their conduct would prove the accuracy of his words. Was it a strange coincidence, or was it divine foreknowledge that a Lazarus should rise from the dead? Faced with the evidence of his resurrection, the Pharisees and priests from that day forth took counsel to put Jesus to death.